Hey everyone, this is Achyuta Bhava from Nightlight Astrology. Happy Monday, everybody. Today we're going to take a look at Venus's square with Neptune, which is perfecting between today and tomorrow, as well as Venus's sextile with Jupiter. So I'm kind of grouping them all together today as one happy transit. So that's what we're going to take a look at. I have a short reading for you guys that comes from an essay we're going to look at today called Aphrodite's Justice by James Hillman. You guys know I'm a big James Hillman fan, so some really brilliant stuff, a little bit from the I Ching. We're going to take a look at some of the archetypal combinations in general this week, maybe a little bit more on that tomorrow. Today, a little bit of a meditative piece to begin our week as we have a week toned by Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune. Really a pretty nice week overall. Before I dive into that, I want to remind you guys that my new class, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystics, starts on November 13th. So it is coming up now really quickly. You have just a little bit more time to sign up using the early bird rate. So make sure you take advantage of that. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to my website, nightlightastrology.com. Click on the courses page, click on the first year course page in particular, scroll down to learn more about it. It's over 100 hours worth of classroom content. We have typically it's about 3 weeks on and then a week or two off with an optional breakout study and tutoring session held live over Zoom webinar in between major units. That's 30 classes plus maybe an additional 8 study sessions or 10 study sessions or something like that. Then there's 12 guest lectures. There's tons of bonus content. So for people who are looking to really take their astrology, studies of astrology to the next level, establish a lifelong understanding of astrology for yourself and to be able to use in your own life or to be able to read for other people, this is my foundational program. I've led going on 2,000 people or so through the program now. And it's really probably the best thing I've ever created. It really is all of my best work poured into one learning experience. At any rate, if you have any questions about it, feel free to email us info@nightlightastrology.com. You have any questions about the program whatsoever, a lot of the questions are answered on the website page, so be sure to check it out. But also, don't forget the early bird payment is in effect until the week that class starts, so you have just a couple of weeks left to take advantage of that. You have to do it before the class begins. There's a payment plan if you need it, and then there's also need-based tuition for people who might need assistance. If that might be you, check it out, see if you qualify. Try to make sure that nobody's priced out of studying a spiritual topic. So if you need some help for whatever reasons, you're part-time, only part-time employed, or you're a single parent or receiving disability, or you're on a fixed budget because of retirement or something like that, just reach out, tell us your situation. We'll see if we can work with you. So at any rate, now that being said, let's look at the real-time clock and let's take a look at the transits that are perfecting in the next couple of days. I'm really excited about these because last week was a little bit tough. We had a lot of Mars Pluto action, and there was the feeling of like misfortune, kind of unfortunate things that are sort of in the air when you got that heavy Mars Pluto dynamic, which is now separating. Mars is also about to pick up dignity; it's going to move into Scorpio pretty soon. We also can see that this week Venus is moving into a sextile with Jupiter. Venus in Sagittarius moving into a sextile with Jupiter in Aquarius. And Venus in Sagittarius is making a square with Neptune in Pisces. What do these planets have in common? They're both in Jupiter-ruled signs. Also, Pisces is the double-bodied water sign of the fish and the place where Venus is exalted. So not surprising that Venus has its exaltation in Pisces. Venus is born on the ocean, born on the waves. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today and some really interesting ways of thinking about Venus and Neptune overall. But this week has a feeling of auspiciousness around it with a very harmonious Venus-Jupiter sextile, a good square between Venus and Neptune, which to my mind, there's always some warnings. We'll talk about those this week too. But Venus-Neptune is a lovely aspect mostly. Certainly there's some really uplifting and, almost like a blissful side of this transit that I really like. And I think we could use that given, some of the heaviness of the Pluto transits that we dealt with the Sun and Mars last week and so forth. Though we will eventually have to see down the road a little bit further, we're going to talk about Mercury coming back through the square to Pluto. For example, you can already see that as Pluto turns direct. Remember, Mercury's retrograde started with Mercury in the square with Pluto stationed, as Pluto was stationing and turning direct. Now, as this is coming back around, we're seeing more and more and more of the things that began under the Mercury retrograde coming full circle. For example, in the news, the whistleblower around Facebook, and now there's apparently, I saw on social media this morning, there's more and more information being released about Facebook. Saw something similar happening in the NFL with released documentation. More and more of that starting to come forth. Those are perfect examples in the news of, say, Mercury and Pluto starting to reveal and uncover more and more things that were hidden. So you're going to see a little bit more of that in the upcoming weeks, because Mercury's got to go back through the square with Pluto. That's just kind of starting as Mercury's picking up speed again. But for now, for this week, the news is pretty positive overall. Not that Mercury Pluto is bad either. There's definitely some positives to that aspect. It's kind of in the background building up. But what I really like about this week again is Venus hitting the sextile to Jupiter while squaring Neptune. Let's take a look at how that's going to unfold. So this is October 25th. You're going to see Venus go through the square with Neptune between 25th, 26th, finishing up by the 27th. So between now and October 27th on Wednesday, seeing that finish up. Then you're seeing Venus come through sextile with Jupiter by Thursday. And Friday, it's just starting. Venus is just starting to separate from that aspect with Jupiter. But you should be able to feel the good influence of that all the way through Saturday, October 30th, while Mars also changes signs and picks up dignity in Scorpio. Then next week, we're going to see Mercury pull through the square to Pluto. But for now, like, that's a really nice turn of events. You're getting Mars in better dignity, because and also protected from the sun's beams, starting to appear as a morning star in its own dignity. You've got Venus with combining with Jupiter. Venus and Neptune's not too bad. Mercury and Venus are actually coming together in sextile, which is nice. So overall, I love this turn of events right now. It's a little uplift from last week overall. So today I want to talk about kind of the Venus, Neptune, Jupiter combination on the whole. And I want to start by telling you guys about a dream that I had. So occasionally I have dreams where in the dream I become lucid, or I wake up in the night or in the morning after, and I realize that my dream was somehow resembled a transit. And sometimes there's personal meaning to it, and I'm like, it's like a direct personal message to me. And other times it literally feels like I'm having a dream that's helping me, like the oracle takes me to the dream classroom to sometimes understand archetypal combinations and teachings inherent in combinations. And sometimes it's both personal and a personal teaching for me, and there's like something that just helps me understand more as an astrologer. I promise you, if you work with archetypes long enough in the study of astrology, you'll get similar downloads. You can get it while being out. You could see someone resembling the transit and target while you're, you know, picking up, you know, something for the house or something like that, you know. Or you could have something in a dream or whatever. So the archetypes work with you. At any rate, so this dream that I had last night. So in the dream, I'm in a car driving with my family in a tropical location. I'm in the back seat, and I'm not sure, I can't remember who was driving. It was my kids and my wife and my mother in particular. And so we're all driving in the car, and I look at my hand and I realize that there's my wedding ring, and then there's another wedding ring. And this wedding ring is like an engagement ring. It looks more like an engagement ring than like a wedding band. And it's on another finger. It's not on like the wedding finger. And I don't for a minute think that it's really about another woman. It's nothing like that. It looks, the ring on my finger is the most beautiful thing maybe I've ever seen. And it was so beautiful that as I was becoming lucid in the dream on several occasions, which I'll explain in a minute, I actually thought, there's nothing like this in the real world. Like in the waking world, there's nothing as beautiful as this. I've never seen anything like this. So I don't know if you guys have ever had that kind of experience where there's something in a dream that you see or experience and you're like, this is not like an earthly thing. This is some other thing. Anyway, it was like that. And it was this beautiful, translucent, multicolored, multidimensional looking wedding ring. And it was on a different finger than the, I don't remember which finger, but it was not on my ring finger because I had my wedding band on as well. And the, it was just sparkling and beautiful. It was like it was filled with rainbow colors and looked like diamonds, but from like another planet. And I was looking at this ring and I realized that this was like a spirit ring. You know, it was like a wedding band between me and God or something, or spirit or the divine or source or whatever we want to call it. And I was so enamored by it, so overwhelmed by how beautiful it was. And I felt the urge rising up in me to tell everyone in the car while we were driving in this beautiful tropical location, oh my God, you know, stop the car. Look at my ring. Look at this thing. Look at it, you know. But something pulled me back and I realized like, no, that would be really dangerous. It would be dangerous because I could make other people jealous or envious. I wouldn't want my wife to misunderstand what it is, you know, or something like that. Not that like she would, but like just, it was this weird rush of hesitation to show anyone. And then this other feeling of like, it's not something to gloat over. It's not, you can't, it's something that's very private and it's not meant to be like gloated over, like, oh, look at this, look at what I've got, right? So I like put my hand over it and I was like, oh, wow, you know, like, holy crap. And I was like peeking at it while we were driving. And there was a storm that was just passing in the sky as we were driving in this car. And we came to this clearing where there was a beach and there was lots of people at the beach. And I pointed to the sky because there were four rainbows in the sky, four of them at the same time over the ocean. And the rainbows looked exactly like the ring. Like they were the most beautiful. They were just otherworldly cosmic rainbows of some kind. They just looked like jewels. And as I'm relaying this, it sounds like an LSD trip, but this is literally what I was seeing. I'm looking over the ocean. There's these four rainbows. They're totally beautiful over the ocean. And they're just the bands of color and the sparkles. And it wasn't like color that I've seen here. It was color from some other place. And everyone saw it. My wife, my kids, my mom, everyone saw it. And we stopped the car and we got out at the beach and we went like kind of, you know, walking like, oh, like looking up at these rainbows, walking down to the ocean. And I sat down on the sand and I looked up and right over my head was like a cloud of really dense cloud of butterflies that also looked exactly like the rainbows. And these, one of the butterflies landed right on my eye. And I like just closed my eye and just like let it, I could feel its wings like opening and I could kind of see it from the periphery of my other eye. And I was like, oh my God. Like, and then I had this experience where I like closed my eyes because I didn't want the butterfly to move. I didn't want the butterfly to leave. I can't explain it. It was so profound. It was like realizing this is the most beautiful thing that has ever touched me. It's some kind of other ethereal angelic butterfly and it's on my eye and I want to look at the butterflies above me because they're so beautiful. But even more beautiful is allowing this butterfly to sit on my eye because this is where it wants to be. And I don't want to disturb it. I can't behold its beauty. I can't selfishly take in its beauty, which is what I really want to do, but I can't selfishly take in its beauty because it wants to rest on my eye. And I have to let it do that. It would be like a sin to not let this beautiful butterfly like rest on my eye. Right. And it was, oh my God, it was so profound. I can't explain how intensely blissful it felt in the dream. And I don't have dreams like this. Like this was something else. And then eventually it flew away and I opened my eyes and I got to see them again. And I was like trying to find somebody. It was my wife and kids were like playing, you know, down by the water. They were just so happy. And I was like trying to find someone to explain like, oh, it was actually more beautiful, not looking at them, not being able to see how beautiful they were, but just knowing that something so beautiful was resting on my eyes and making them close because it wanted to rest on my eye. And that was more beautiful than seeing them. And I had to tell someone, you know, but I couldn't, there was no one to tell except for all of you. So at any rate, so then, so everyone was down by the ocean looking at these rainbows, and the butterflies were then like gone. And I was like, okay, wow, this is like something else. And I didn't care about the ring on my finger anymore, or like if anyone could see it or not. Like that part was like gone now. But then I was walking down the beach, and I was with my wife, and she started crying. I said, "What's wrong?" And she looked around and she said, "Some people can't see it. Some people can't see the rainbows. They can't see them." And she's like, "That's so sad. It's so sad that why can't some people see them?" And my wife, it was like realizing in the dream anyway, I had this really simple realization that my wife was very saintly. And I felt a lot of love for her because it hadn't even occurred to me. I hadn't even been looking carefully enough. I was so enamored by the rainbow that I couldn't even recognize that there were some people that couldn't see it. And more important to her than looking at the rainbow was looking at the people who couldn't see it. Right. And then there was it was like this other really deep teaching about compassion and about, you know, it's kind of similar to the butterfly resting on your eye, letting the butterfly rest, even if you can't look at it, that my wife was embodying another teaching that was kind of similar. She was looking at people who couldn't see the rainbows and feeling such deep compassion for them and crying for them. And it was more important to her to look upon their faces with compassion than it was for her to turn and look at the rainbows. Oh my God, I'm telling you what, this dream, I woke up and it was like, I felt like I should be crying when I woke up from this dream, but I was just breathless because it was so beautiful. And as I woke up from the dream, the very first thing I thought was, oh yeah, that's right. Venus is squaring Neptune right now. Venus is squaring Neptune. Here's this sublime vision of beauty. It's not a private beauty. It's a beauty in service. It's not an enamored beauty. It's a beauty that also generates compassion. And I just sat with that, man. I'm telling you, this blew my mind this morning. I did a whole hour take trying to explain the dream the first time, and I couldn't do it because I was getting emotional, and it was like really, really hard to explain what I had seen right away. So I went and worked out, and after working out, I sat and did some meditating because I tried to record first thing when I woke up. And then after I did my meditation and worked out, then I was like, okay, I think I can distill this a little bit easier now. So anyway, that was like a shocking dream. And then it reminded me of a couple of things. One, it reminded me of Aphrodite's Justice, an essay by James Hillman. And I'm going to read you an excerpt from this today because there is a passage in this book that reminds me a lot of the dream that I had and of this combination archetypally in general. The second thing that's really interesting is that I cast the I Ching asking for some reflective advice, feedback about not only the dream, but the transit after all this happened this morning. And I got a hexagram that also contains a very profound teaching. So what I'm going to do is I want to talk about the hexagram first and then read you a little piece of this essay and end with some thoughts about Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune this week. And then I think what we'll do tomorrow is break down the archetypal combination a little bit more, but let's just get a feeling for this energy first, right? And sometimes James Hillman has a way with words that's so profound, and the I Ching has a way of addressing things that are also really profound. So that's where we're going to go today. So hexagram 35 came back for me this morning, and that hexagram is called promotion. What I love about this hexagram is that the sequence that it's a part of, hexagram 34 that comes right before it in the I Ching describes a person of strength and power, but it's the kind of power that asserts itself so strongly that it can get one of the texts where one of the meanings of that hexagram has to do with like the image of like a ram or a goat getting like its horns stuck in a fence because it's too powerful. It's too much. This is about rising brilliance and power, number 34, but too much get entangled, too willful, too strong, too boastful gets entangled. 35 continues the rise of brilliance and greatness and strength and power and beauty, like a flame rising upward. That's kind of one of the images of the hexagram. But there is a teaching in this hexagram that has to do with how to advance so that you don't get stuck. Advancement could mean good fortune. It could mean the building of wealth. It could be the building of strength or muscle if you're trying to, you know, put on gains at the gym, or it could be the advance of a practice if you're trying to get better at something, or it could be the advance of, you know, a relationship, or just anything, anything that you're hoping will get better or will grow or will become more. So this hexagram says that things will advance, but they have to advance toward brightness in a tender manner, and also in a way that takes into consideration the joy and happiness of others. So one of the teachings, for example, line 3 in particular, I really like in this hexagram. So it says, line 3 is in correlation with line 6 and at the position for moving upward. However, line 4 in front is the representative line of the inner lower trigram yin to stop, signifying that it encounters line 4's interference while advancing upward. This causes regret. It stays at the top of the lower trigram, and where there are other two other lines that represent the people. And when it finds that it has the same intent as the people in the two lines below it, and it has therefore unanimous harmonious resolution to advance, then it can move forward. And it ends up at line 6, which is a place for the shrine, which is actually the symbol of a country or a shrine or a temple, something that brings people together. And it's only when this line in the hexagram recognizes what brings everyone together and that you can't move, advance, enhance something without some kind of unanimous concern for others, without service, without compassion, without care, without some kind of consensus that what is good for me is good for others, that it's only in that gentle, considerate, service, compassion-oriented spirit that things can grow and become very, very beautiful, and things can advance or build in strength or whatever the case might be. So there's this really good teaching in Hexagram 35, as I've understood it over the years, that has to do with, when things are growing and rising, what continues prosperity and growth is a general concern for others, the welfare of others. And it's interesting that at the top of this hexagram, kind of the pinnacle of success, is a temple, something that truly brings everyone together. Did you know that Venus was associated with piety? Piety and cleanliness and faith all went together, because in most ancient religious traditions, the adornment of the altars, the cleanliness of the sanctuaries or temples, the tending and care of a ritual decorum, things like that, were part and parcel of religious rituals. So, for example, when I was in South Central America doing work with different ayahuasqueros, the care and concern for the ceremonial space, for how it's set up, for how it's managed, Native American teepee ceremonies that I've been a part of at different parts in my life, and in a few of those ceremonies that I was a part of, the care and concern for how things were done, the order in which things were done, never without an eye for beauty, right? So the I Ching is pointing to something similar here, that the things that are most beautiful, most powerful, tend to please the gods, tend to be beautiful, and they tend to enhance the welfare and happiness of others. And that with care for others and care for these higher principles, real beauty is something that, as it grows within us, is also cultivating our concern for others, that it generates within us a sense of justice, compassion, equality, etc. So I love this hexagram because the 36, the hexagram that follows it in the I Ching, is called Eclipsing the Light. Sometimes it's translated as Eclipsing the Light, or the dark, or the light tarnished, or something like that. And it has to do with when In a sense, when things rise forever and they get so bright and so powerful, eventually it comes along and a tyrant, a dictator, someone evil, you know, whatever, and they want to topple the kingdom and take over. And then, you know, we had a golden age. Things were so good. And then an evil tyrant comes in. This is kind of how the cycles of things work. There's dark ages and light ages and so forth. And in Hexagram 36, there's a story about a guy who has to feign insanity and hide his light because there's an evil king that comes in and takes over. And so the light has to be hidden sometimes as well, which is interesting because that was also a part of my dream. So to care for, if we want things to grow, remember Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune have a lot to do with sparkly things, right? Things that grow, advance, promote, gain, that are very attractive or appealing. But there's warnings built into the I Ching about this that were present in my dream as well. Be careful not to hoard the light. Be careful not to, when things are growing or gaining, tenderness, gentleness, non-enviousness, non-covetousness, don't be selfish. If there's something truly beautiful, be concerned that it be shared with others. If there's something really beautiful, be concerned that you're in service of that beauty, not that you're trying to possess it. And these are things that are, it's like the ethics of real beauty, the ethics of transcendental love and beauty. Okay, so I Ching number 35, totally in line with that. Let me read you something now from an essay by James Hillman called Aphrodite's Justice. It was given, I believe, in Italy. I could be getting this wrong, but I think it's in Italian as well as English. So it's a really short read if you want to buy it on Amazon. I don't know if it's still available or not. I got it years ago, but it's about 75 pages long, and it's probably half of that because every other page is the Italian translation. Anyway, at the beginning of the text, he says, he makes a little invocation. Great lady, be kind to us today. He's talking about Aphrodite Venus. 6 years ago, on another shore of this Mediterranean, out of which Aphrodite was born and is still being born, still generating all along the shores of these waters, flirting cafes, stretched alluringly along the beaches, moving to music and dark clubs. Yes, she rises daily, nightly from these waters along the coasts and on the islands like Capri, inviting hedonists from all over the world. Anyway, on this other shore, 6 years ago in Rimini, I proposed at a gathering of scholars under the auspices of the president of your Italian Republic, a revision of the fundamental basis of psychology derived from three principles: beauty, justice, and destiny. These three classical principles with mythic proportions are deeper and more appropriate to the soul's concerns than any other trivium of concepts, such as nature, nurture, and individuality, or reason, will, and emotion, or ego, superego, and id, or even those ancient three, nous, psyche, and physis, which today we name as mind, soul, and body. It is in the spirit of this proposal that our conversation today takes its start, and we shall be exploring in particular the relation of beauty and justice. I love that intro. It's such a nice invocation of Aphrodite. Now, I want to read you a couple of passages where some of the core of what he's saying in this essay comes forward. The long history of Christianized philosophy has driven ethics from aesthetics, justice from beauty, so that we customarily believe that you cannot be both good and beautiful, ethical and alluring, nor can the pleasures of the senses be the path to truth. A piece of art or a novel may be recommended for its moral instruction. In its morality lies its beauty. But never does the Christian divide admit that in its very beauty is its morality, since beauty works as a calling to better things, pulling at the heart to love, to the mind to imagine more vividly. Moreover, morality without beauty stifles both heart and mind, boring, dull. It does not take hold, does not prompt the justice it advocates. In fact, Saul Bellow, Nobel laureate novelist, said, "Dullness is worse than obscenity. A dull book is wicked. It may be as nice as pie and sweet as can be, but if it is banal and boring, it is evil." So we shall be stepping around psychology and philosophy both and turn back to mythic figures in search of Aphroditic justice. I'm telling you right now, this essay will blow your mind if you read the whole thing. So later in the book, as he's already outlining, first of all, let's just be really clear that what he's saying is that at the core of concerns about equality, dignity, fairness, goodness in society, virtue at the core of what makes society the most happy and harmonious as possible is Aphrodite, is beauty, is imagination, and is a sense of the aesthetic that brings people together. That beauty is at the core of what creates justice. Not that justice, if followed, allows for us to go out and enjoy things sensually, which is often the way that it gets flipped around. Oh, you can be a consumer. You can enjoy this garden of earthly delights so long as you follow the rules. The rules come first, don't break them, and then, you know, you can enjoy within the bounds of the rules. And he's trying to say, you know, what if we rethought of this and said that actually what generates the most harmonious modes of living and the most harmonious customs, rites, rituals, concern with fairness, dignity, etc., is a concern for the common experience of beauty, which could be extended into qualities like joy, happiness, and appreciation for beauty in the world. So he goes on later. In another section, he's talking about the word cosmos in relation to the word cosmetic, which is part of the etymology, and cosmos and cosmetic being related to Aphrodite and beauty. So here he says, cosmos, however, means in good order, to sit in order as a government, duly, becomingly, decently, in awakata kosmon means shamefully. Cosmos connotes both aesthetic and ethical order, both adornment and decency. The night sky exhibits the cosmos by the spangled display of stars and the rhythmical, lawful procession of the planetary bodies. For us today, it is odd indeed to find in the one term meanings such as embellishment, ornament, and the dress of women, yet also the idea of ruling and government, of honor and credibility. Today, cosmetic is disdainfully superficial, and cosmology has been so emptied out of beauty that it refers mainly to the study of the Big Bang, the black hole, and measurements in unimaginable magnitudes, or to cosmonauts whirling through gaseous space. Cosmos eventually came to be used, e.g. the New Testament, as we say world, and as a world ensouled, as anima mundi, which Plotinus in late Greek thought said is always an Aphrodite. Anima mundi is always an Aphrodite. The implication is clear. The world is also a presentation to be appreciated rather than only a problem to be figured out. Offenses to its display are unjust to the order of things, and societal justice is not katakosmon, shameful and ugly both. The walls between the ethical and the aesthetic dissolve. Attention to aesthetics is ethical behavior, and ethical behavior is an aesthetic display. Another of these conceptual walls also dissolves, the one between aesthetics and biology, one housed in the arts building, the other across campus among the sciences. The ancient world and the world outside of Christian hegemony attested to a love goddess as a biological power generating in the natural world and linking all living things in affiliation. Edward Wilson's term biophilia is the term biology uses for the love of living forms for one another in a shared cosmos. This cross-species affiliation originates in flowers. Yes, flowers. Some 100 million years ago, writes Lauren Isley in his startling paleontological essay, How Flowers Changed the World, quote, flowers were not to be found anywhere on the five continents, only the cold, dark, monotonous green, whose plant life possessed no other color. Then there occurred a soundless, violent explosion that lasted millions of years. It marked the emergence of the angiosperms, the flowering plants. Flowers changed the face of the planet. Without them, even man himself would never have existed. Isley explains, that the earlier world of giant reptiles and huge trees was dying away. The wooden, stiff, sky-reaching forms were giving way to things that glowed here and there with strange colors, fruits and little intricately carved seed cases, and produced concentrated foods, that reproductive system of flowering plants. This from biology could as well have been stated by anthropology about rituals, and this is what I was talking about earlier, that propitiate the goddess of sexual love and of fruit and flowers as the originating propagating force in the world. Or it could have been stated by mythology of Venus Genetrix and of Aphrodite, of whom the early poet Stasinus writes, "She put on the garments which the Graces and the Horae had made for her and had dyed in spring flowers such as the Horae bear, in crocus and hyacinth and the bloom of the rose, the flowers of Narcissus and Lily, in such fragrant garments as Aphrodite clothed in all seasons." Or from Marsilio Ficino, who writes, "Venus seeds nature with its green things to bloom everywhere, not just to make us alive, but younger, making us overflow with a lively spirit." Or in the words of Dylan Thomas, "The force that through the green fuse drives the flowers drives my green age." So just a beautiful passage from Hillman. And what is he really concerned with? He's concerned that until there is some kind of deeper collective recognition of the beauty that is the world, not the beauty that is Hallmark the world, you know, like a Hallmark's version of the world. We're talking about some inherent appreciating capacity that human beings have to collectively look and say, this is beautiful. Not just to look out in nature, but to look up, as in the nature extending into the cosmos. Remember that Venus comes from the castrated genitals of the sky god Uranus. And Uranus is a Uranus. I'm not sure I'm saying it correctly, but it's kind of an O in it. But the castrated genitals come into the ocean, and from the blood and semen, this foam rises and Venus comes out. Venus is a goddess that we often relate to, like the sort of sensual earthy realm through, say, like Taurus in astrology. Fair enough. Venus is exalted in Pisces, which is a watery sign. And Venus's birth comes as Venus rises out of this kind of airy, ethereal foam that's sitting on the top of the ocean, and is a goddess born between water and sky. It's a really important distinction, because even though Venus has a very earthy, sensual dimension to her, she also has an airy one. This is her rulership of Libra, the sign of the balance and of justice. And it's important to remember this kind of ethereal dimension of Venus, that when we look upon the world, as when we look up at the sky, that there is a sense of the connectedness of the things above and below, that there in the world exists the same geometry, number, math, and rhythms, the invisible laws of music and of the invisible orderings of things, that we can see those things in nature. One of the beautiful things about Venus's cycles, if you look at Venus's retrograde cycles over the course of her eight-year recurring Venus retrograde cycles, she can make kind of like a flower pattern in the sky in her pictures, in the tracing the movements of Venus through those five cycles in 8 years. There's something about Venus that is always calling us to see the complete whole in the part from the standpoint of beauty and appreciation. And so Venus has this very ethereal dimension. And what Hillman's really saying in this essay is, if we were to develop an appreciating capacity for the beauty inherent in nature, not just the good parts of nature, but the totality of nature and its movements, and not just the earthly nature, but the heavenly nature as well, that we'd come back into a sense of what and where the word cosmetic comes from. Cosmos, cosmetic, everything in a well-arranged whole. And this appreciating capacity is actually at the core, Hillman proposes, of what allows for people to create, have a deeper understanding of balance, fairness, justice, equality, compassion, forgiveness, all virtues. He's saying, what if we, instead of saying that there's kind of virtue over here, and as long as you kind of keep the rules, then, you know, you can go and enjoy sensual things, like this very moralistic split between like morality and beauty. as if they're divorced somehow. But Hillman is saying it's from the appreciating capacity that we have to see things as a well-arranged whole, all things, all the good and the bad, all of the things happening with an appreciating capacity that allows us to have a real concern for other people's equity, for their dignity, for their rights, or for their happiness. And I was amazed by how well Hexagram 35 addressed this very same idea, that things are growing brighter, stronger, more beautiful, more fortunate, but not if it's not done delicately, carefully, with an eye for beauty, and with compassion, care, and service for others. Otherwise, you're stuck between two hard places. Hexagram 34, things grow, but they're too strong, headstrong, willful, selfish, and they get entangled in a wall, like horns getting stuck in a fence. Or Hexagram 36, they get so bright, but maybe almost too bright, and then they have to be hidden away because people will try to attack or take them or something like that. Then I went back to the dream image. Here's this beautiful ring. It's my ring. It's the ring that weds me to the cosmos. Maybe everyone has one that they can't see. And it's nothing for my wife to be threatened about. And I was worried about that, not her in the dream. It's nothing for anyone to be threatened by, but it's also nothing for me to gloat about. It's a private little amazing translucent Venus, Neptune, Jupiter wedding band of spirit. We all have one. Okay. And then we arrive at this beach where everyone's seeing this beautiful light display, but some people aren't. Few people, like there's here pockets of people here there who can't see it. First thing that happens is a butterfly, this beautiful translucent Venusian Venus Neptune-y butterfly lands on my eye. And I want to keep my eyes open so I can look at the butterflies, but I have to just say, it's even more beautiful for me not to be able to behold it, but for me to be in service to it. So when we start to have this appreciating capacity, this is very bhakti yoga too, by the way, this appreciating capacity allows us to be in service to the beauty. And there's a taste in being in service to the beauty that goes beyond even being able to behold it. That was the first lesson of the stream that I took away. The second was on the beach, everyone's beholding this thing, and my wife is turned away compassionately in tears, looking with concern for the people who can't. And it's very similar to the thing that was happening with the butterfly on my eye, but also it was like a reiteration of it, because then I went down to the beach and I'm looking at the rainbow, and I didn't even see that people weren't looking. And here's my wife concerned. There's Venus. There's the goddess. And I said, I had this moment in the dream. I said, my wife is a goddess. You know, it's like there's Aphrodite in a sense. Real beauty is a concern for the whole. Real beauty is so intimately tied to justice. And if you can appreciate, real appreciating capacity that we have sees beauty everywhere. And so we see it in all souls, in all beings. And then anything that grows and appreciates and grows in beauty and value, anything that's promoted, anything that's growing, if it doesn't come along with compassion and service, care and concern for others, appreciation for others, it's not real beauty. So real beauty is real justice. Check out this essay by James Hillman, Aphrodite's Justice, if you want to read a great essay. I love that essay. It really changed my life the first time I read it. I hope that this makes some sense to all of you today. This is where I'm going with this beautiful energy that's coming through this week with Venus, Jupiter, and Neptune. But tomorrow what we're going to do is break down the archetypal combination in depth. Until then, if you start having stories, as always, use the hashtag grabbed. Tell us how those grahas are showing up and giving you a picture. Maybe you had a cool dream too. I'd love to hear from you guys. If you want to email us your story, it's grabbed@nightlightastrology.com. All right, take care. And we'll talk more tomorrow about, we'll do more tomorrow on the same archetypal combination. All right, take it easy, everyone. Bye.